Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman, brought to you by globalresearch.ca. Visit the site. Oh, visit it daily. Visit it several times a day because new material can go up anytime, often in the morning early, but it can go up later as well. And always important things for people to follow. And as you're able, we get our support only from readers. Those able to, we certainly do appreciate your support. And this program goes right along with the website. My guest today, I hope, is Mike Farrell. Mike is a noted activist. He's an author. He's an actor, best known for that. And he was best known for the role that he played in the TV series MASH. Today, he's a regular lecturer on progressive issues, including human rights, his opposition to imperial wars, torture, poverty, and the death penalty. And, of course, that's the reason he's coming on, plus his new book. He has a biography titled Just Call Me Mike, A Journey to Actor and Activist. And his newest book is titled Off Mule and Man. It's an account of his cross-country book tour, about 5 weeks, and his observations, encounters, presentations, and conversations along the way. Mike, are we connected? Not yet. Well, he's a couple of hours earlier than I am. Well, hopefully he's just brushing his teeth and he'll join us. Let me tell you a little bit more. The book covers about a 5 week tour that he made. He did it in a car and he named the car Mule. So the mule is the car and the man, of course, is himself. And it's a bit of a takeoff, on John Steinbeck's book that I read many, many, many years ago of Mice and Men. Oh, a good book. Mike stopped in about 25 cities, and he met with people along the way, and he gave presentations talking about the book, of course, talking about the things that he believes in. And he does a fair amount of writing as well as lecturing. I wanted to mention with him, hopefully we'll get him on. He wrote an article for the Huffington Post back on the 19th of April. And he called it Obama Stands Nuremberg on Its Head. And he talked about, Nuremberg stood for a great deal. It stood for Justice Robert Jackson, who Mike quotes a good bit in the article. Justice Jackson, we certainly mentioned him on this program before. He referred to the supreme international crime. Well, torture stems from the supreme international crime, which is the crime of peace or the war of illegal aggression. And that was the crime that got the convicted Nazis either sent away for long prison terms or, in the worst cases, to be hanged. Torture is an outgrowth of the supreme international crime. And Mike talks a good bit about that, and he wrote about it in this article. Well, we have a break coming up, and I do hope we'll get Mike on. Let's take a break and we'll be right back.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
I guess I'm all by myself, at least temporarily. So what I think I'll do is shift focus, and if we get Mike on, we'll shift back to him and his book and his cross-country tour. But let's talk issues. That's what I do. I write about them. We talk about them all the time on this program. Oh, big ones. I got an email this morning. Political prisoners is a big issue for me. We talk about it often enough on this program, and I write about it very often. I exchange emails with three innocent men, Muslim men, wrongly convicted. And the word must be getting around because I got an email from a fourth person this morning who I don't know very much about. Well, I really don't know anything about him. When you exchange emails with somebody in prison, the way it starts off is the prison sends you an email and it says this individual requested permission to exchange emails with you, something to that effect. And then it asks you either to accept it or not accept it. And there are two spots to click either way. And the instructions say, click here or there, and then send, but don't change anything in this email. So I sent it back, and I'll wait to see what happens, I assume. I'm not certain where this person is, whether he's in the same prison as the others I exchange emails with. But we'll see. And I'm very happy to do it. It takes some time, but it's something that needs to be done. Whatever is important to do, there's always time to do it. And that's certainly one of the things I stand by. So I'll exchange emails with four people in prison. And if more want to do it with me, I'll be very happy to do it. I am not happy about innocent people being behind bars. And I'm not happy about people who may have done petty things being behind bars at all. But worst of all, being sentenced to be there for an extended period of time. Because if they were well off and they could get good legal counsel, they probably wouldn't be there at all. But most of the ones who are there are the ones who can't do that. The poor, mostly minorities, blacks, Latinos, two-thirds of the prison population, most of them there for nonviolent offenses. They shouldn't be there at all. My goodness, if I were the president on my first day, I would release all of them in federal prison, and I would make a very, very strong statement to all the state authorities to do exactly the same thing. And by golly, if I did it, how could they not at least do it to some extent? Think of the money we would save that we could use for more useful purposes. Oh, I'd do a lot more than that, but that would be a quickie to do real, real fast. Still no Mike, huh, Carrie? There's so much going on. I'm doing a series of articles that we will begin discussing on Monday. Ellen Brown will be on the program on Monday, and she wrote an extraordinary book. She's been on a couple of times, two or three times before, and she's now a regular on the program because of what she does is so good. Her writing is so important. She wrote an important book in 2007, and it's updated as of the end of last year in its third edition. It's called Web of Death. It's a story about how central banking, controlled by private banking, bankers, have entrapped us in a web of death. And very sadly, most countries have privately controlled central banks. Not all of them, but most of them. I want to talk about it more on Monday, but, I'll give you a couple of snapshots. One thing that every time I read something that Ellen writes, well, the book I was a little familiar with, I never read it in the detail that I read it this time because I decided to begin writing about the book. And once I started, I couldn't stop. So I ended up writing about the entire book. It's a big book. And I split this so much. It's so encyclopedic in depth and so important. Again, once I started, I couldn't stop. So I did it all, but I split it into pieces. So I have a series of articles. The first one I put out on Monday, and I simply titled it Reviewing Ellen Brown's Web of Debt, Part 1. Part 2 will go out tomorrow. It'll be up on Global Research. Part 1 is up now. Oh, read it. Absolutely read it. You will learn all the things that Ellen taught me. Well, I know that our Federal Reserve and Bank of England and the big ones that we know about, they're private banker-controlled central banks, and that is the problem. That's the reason we're in the mess we're in right now. Well, Ellen taught me before I read the book, but she covers it in the book also, that in the colonial days in our country, in the U.S., I say our country, people listen to this program from all over the world. I sure know it because I get emails from people, and I love it. And I try to answer everybody who emails me. But here in the U.S., back in the 1600s, before the Bank of England ever existed, I think the Bank of England was the second central bank. If I'm right, I think there was a central bank in Austria before the Bank of England. But 1694, the Bank of England was established. And I don't believe initially as a banker cartel-owned bank, but it became that, and it's been that way ever since. Even though at the end of the Second World War, England nationalized the bank, but they did it in name only. It's still controlled by private bankers, so it was a masquerade. It was a fraud. they can use any words they want. Private bankers run the bank. And a famous Rothschild family that were the banking powers before the Morgans and the Rockefellers surpassed them here in this country in the early part of the last century. But one or more Rothschild, I think at least two of them, made the statement that I really don't give a damn what laws the country passes as long as I control the money of a country. So Nathan Rothschild, who took over the Bank of England, the king may have had a crown on his head, but the real crown was on Nathan's head because he ran the country. It's the same way in this country. The bankers run the country. The bankers who control the money run the country. Well, back in colonial days, we printed our own money in the colonies, and they called it scrip. S-C-R-I-P, scrip. It was not created by private bankers. It was created by the state of Massachusetts, state of Pennsylvania, and the other states. I believe the state of Pennsylvania did it best. But under that system, the colonies had roughly 25 years of prosperous growth, inflation-free, and no taxes. Now, how about that? Well, I learned something I never knew before when I read Ellen's book in detail. For all the horrors that he committed, and he certainly will be forever in the annals of the great horror-committing individuals in history, Adolf Hitler did one thing right. The Versailles Treaty post-World War I was so horrendous, it just absolutely decimated Germany. You could defeat a country, and I've quoted Michael Hudson on this, and John Adams said the same thing. Michael Hudson will be on tomorrow. You could defeat a country either militarily or you can do it financially. Well, John Adams, second president in the U.S., said exactly the same thing. Well, Germany was defeated militarily, and they also were defeated post-war financially, because the Versailles Treaty absolutely decimated the country. It just strip-mined of everything of any worth. And it also created a terrible amount of hyperinflation, probably less because of all the money that was printed, and more likely because the German mark was shorted. And you attack a currency by shorting it, the way we did in East Asia in 1997, beginning with attacking the Thailand baht, B-A-H-T, which was the weakest currency in the region. And people like George Soros led the assault, attacking the Thai baht. And it ended up spreading an Asian crisis throughout the so-called Asian tigers. 24 million people were cast into poverty. The great middle class of those countries was absolutely kicked in the butt and struck a terrible blow, many millions never recovering from what we did to them. But this was probably what caused hyperinflation in Germany in 1921 to 23, thereabouts, where the German mark literally was worth less than the paper it was printed on. It was worthless. The story is about needing a wheelbarrow full of marks to buy a loaf of bread. Well, no exaggeration. I quoted the numbers a couple of times in material that I wrote. it was astonishing just to the degree to which the German mark was decimated. Well, at the end of the 1920s, of course, we had the Great Depression. Germany was affected. Hitler came into office the same time as Franklin Roosevelt, 1933. In a few years, he took a prostrate Germany, and he made it prosperous again. Absolutely astonishing. He literally rose it up from the dead. Now, how the devil did he do that? And he did it. He did a lot of it in a few years. And over 5 years, Germany was an economic power. And this was before he really began to rearm. He didn't go to war till 1939. But by 1935, Germany, during the Great Depression, Germany was a prosperous country. Well, he did it because he took the banker-controlled central bank, the Reichsbank, and he made it government-controlled. So the government printed its own money, interest-free, inflation-free, and brought Germany back to life. Why, that son of a gun did one good thing. We have to take another break, and it looks like we're not going to get Mike on.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm so lonely. Well, I can carry on. I can carry on. One quick anecdote. Oh, way back, I hosted another program for a year, and I had on an individual who actually, a Venezuelan who I had met because he came to Chicago. I had him on the program, and an hour program, everything went fine the first 30 minutes. We took a break on the half hour, came back, and no guest. Well, I discovered that I could wing it just fine for half the program. So if I could do it for half, I could do it for all. Well, a few hours later, he contacted me, and he said, the town that he lived in, an hour or so away from Caracas, the town lost all its power, telephone, computer, everything. So he was helpless. We lost contact, and there was no way he could even tell me about it. Well, that's an act of nature. What can we do? Or maybe an act of a rat biting a power line and just knocking out a whole city, I think a small town. Well, anyway, we just carry on and we do it. The show must go on, obviously. Well, I was talking about Ellen Brown's incredible book, and we absolutely will talk more about it on Monday. I'll let you hear it from the woman who wrote the book. But I was talking what Adolf Hitler did for Nazi Germany. This is simple. What he did for Nazi Germany, economically, we could do right here. And every country could do exactly the same thing. The solution is so simple. The easiest solutions aren't done because the bankers would be the ones that had to pay the price instead of nearly everybody else in the country, at least 90% of us, probably 95% of us. So the solution is abolish the Federal Reserve, give government back the power to create money. The U.S. Constitution says only the Congress has the authority to coin money, coin mean, to print it, and regulate the value thereof. That's step one. Step two, let the bankrupt banks go bankrupt and stop giving them our money. And those that can make it on their own, break them up into little pieces. What we need is a system that has many banks, small, local, community, serving the people who can walk into the bank, and they know the people in the bank. I've lived in Chicago for 40 years. When I first came here, I banked in a neighborhood bank that doesn't exist anymore. Oh, the location exists, but not the name. Over 40 years, I underwent about four or five name changes. It's now Chase, J.P. Morgan Chase. It went all the way from the Upper Avenue National Bank. That was the actual name of my bank. It had two branches, one where I was, and about a mile down the street, there was another branch. Well, I knew the manager of my bank, and he did things like one time I deposited a check and I wrote a check that I believe exceeded the amount that I deposited. And it takes a couple of days for a check to clear, so technically I overdrew my account. Well, my goodness, can you imagine all the bells and whistles that will go off at Chase, J.P. Morgan Chase? Well, the bank manager called me and told me what happened. I said, oh, I deposited a check. He said, oh, no problem. Don't worry about it. Everything's fine. Case closed. So break up these giants. Give government back the power to create money. And just like the colonies for 25 years until the system changed, we can talk about that on Monday. I'll talk about it a little bit. Well, I'll tell you here today as well. But we could have the same prosperity they did. The reason the income tax was enacted the same year as the Federal Reserve, 1916, the income tax, I believe, was in February 1913, and the Federal Reserve Act was 2 days before Christmas, December 23rd. It was passed in the middle of the night. Special session was held from 1:30 to 4:30 in the morning on December 23rd. Nobody read the Federal Reserve Act, but it didn't matter because the language is so obscure that even if senators and congressmen read it, they wouldn't understand it. They wouldn't realize what the true meaning of that act was. But of course, it was to give bankers the power to create money, take it away from the government. Well, bankers pretty much had a lot of power before that. Because they still control the banking system, even though they didn't have the power that the Federal Reserve Act gave them. Well, Woodrow Wilson was president then. He signed the act, and he later made some terrible statements. He was a liar, plain and simple. Woodrow Wilson was a college professor. He was a lawyer. He was a PhD. He was the president of Princeton University before he got into politics, and he later said something like, "I'm a very unhappy man. I ruined my country." And he said a lot more, and he railed against the bankers. Well, he knew exactly what he was doing. And if he wasn't sure what this bloody act was, all he had to do was ask. He didn't have to sign it right away. He could have called the people in who drafted this law and said, "Explain it to me, chapter and verse." And it could have sat on his desk for a day, for a month, for 6 months. He didn't have to sign it, but he did. So he knew exactly what he did. He handed over the power to create money to these banking predators, and they've had it ever since. The reason we have an income tax was because these bankers needed an income stream to cover the expense of charging the government interest on its own money. That's the reason we got the federal income tax. It could be eliminated. Well, we've got a few other problems now that we didn't have in 1913. But we could figure a way out of that. There are solutions. And Ellen covers it in her book. Oh, we need a few programs to cover her whole book, and we'll probably do it in a few programs. But let's take another break, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the News Hour. Oh, during the break, I have been shooting desperate emails back and forth with the publisher of Mike's book. Oh, I think she is at least as chagrined as I am, and she's trying very hard to reach him, leaving messages on his cell phone so far to no avail. I guess he doesn't have a pager. I expressed the state of my mind at the moment, but I did it very politely. I don't want to insult anybody. But let's go back to Ellen's book. Again, it's so important that we could spend the whole week, a couple of weeks, talking about her book. There were probably five presidents of the United States who were not happy about the idea of bankers controlling the nation's money. And the first one was Thomas Jefferson. Go back to the colonial days for a minute. The Bank of England was very, very upset that the colonies decided to print their own money and not have the Bank of England control the money and make us pay tribute to them. Our so-called Revolutionary War, a war of independence, had nothing to do with tea. It had nothing to do with taxes. It had everything to do with the fact that we send we let the Bank of England control our money, and they can and they can give us boom or bust at their whim. They can throw us into poverty. They can strip mine our wealth. That's what bankers do. So when we reclaim that power, we have prosperity. We have no taxes. We have no inflation. Well, who wouldn't want a system like that? Well, the Bank of England, well, the English government, the Crown of England, had Benjamin Franklin come over, and they ordered him to give the power back to the Bank of England. But they had, England was going through some great economic distress at the time, and he was asked, how come you have prosperity and we're going through all of this travail? Well, Franklin explained it to them, what we were doing here. And he said things like, you don't have too much, you don't have too many people that you need to employ. You don't have enough money in circulation. Inflation is not caused by printing money. That is an absolute myth. There's no problem printing as much money as you want as long as productivity keeps up with it, as long as it's used for the right purposes. Productive use, industrial uses. Not financialization uses, not casino capitalism uses, the way our casino banks operate. Well, that's why we had prosperity. Well, England thrust us back into a Bank of England control system, and the colonies were thrust into poverty as a result. Jefferson was against this. He could not get the power of money back. Oh, we can talk about it when Ellen comes on. And then James Madison succeeded him. We had a Bank of the United States. That was the first the first central bank before there was a central bank. Jefferson, Madison renewed the charter for 20 years. Andrew Jackson was the next president who said, there's no way in the world I'm going to put up with this. The charter came up for renewal. He vetoed it. He called the Bank of the United States a hydra-headed monster, and he said a lot more, too. Well, Jackson was not my idea of a model president, but on economic issues, he sure was, because we need that kind of president on economic issues today and that kind of policy. The next president who was not happy about having to pay tribute to bankers was Abraham Lincoln. Well, Jefferson and Jackson survived. Lincoln did not. Oh, goodness. You know, I don't know who was behind it, but my first choice was the banking interest that wanted their power back. To finance the Civil War, bankers wanted to charge Lincoln 24 to 36% interest, and he absolutely refused to pay it, so he took back the power to create money, and we produced greenbacks. He got a law passed through Congress, which was essentially called the Greenback Law. As soon as he was assassinated, the law was revoked, and the bankers got their power back. But the Greenback Law gave the government the power to create money interest-free. So the North won the Civil War by creating all the money it wanted, and Lincoln did something else, too. Well, besides creating the world's most powerful military up to that point, he created prosperity. The steel industry began at that time. And we had a pretty prosperous country with a whole array of things that he did. And if we have time when Ellen comes on, once, twice, three times, whatever, we could talk about some of what he did. But basically, by having government-printed money, inflation-free, we had taxes during the Civil War, which was an aberrational period because the nation was at war. And it was one bloody tough war, indeed. So we had taxes, and we had a lot more things that Lincoln did that nobody should be happy about, like suspending habeas corpus. But he did good things, too. He didn't free the slaves. but he took the first step, the Emancipation Proclamation. The 16th Amendment, I believe, freed the slaves. Or was it the 14th Amendment? Later in the year, 1865. I'll have to look that up. I forget which number it was. 1865, Lincoln assassinated earlier in the year. The amendment ratified later in the year that was the enactment of law that freed the slaves. But by printing our own money, we created prosperity in the country, the prosperity that only a very small sliver in the country has today. And during good times, a minority has it. And that's a shrinking minority all the time, because that's the way the system operates. When bankers got the power back again, then things began to go into reverse. Another president that I didn't know about that Ellen mentioned in her book was James Garfield, who was in office less than a year because he was shot. Well, Ellen had a quote by Garfield. I don't have it in front of me now, but it basically was really railing against the banking interest. So did Lincoln. There's a great quote by Lincoln that I used in an earlier article, and Ellen used it as well, where he started out saying he feared for the future of this country, the corporate powers taking over, the bankers taking over, and eventually taking all of our liberties away. Well, that's exactly what's going on now. It has been going on for decades, but it keeps getting worse and worse and worse and worse. So look where we are now. Oh, just in the here and now, away from Ellen's book, I've written so much about it myself. Certainly the global economic crisis, and I don't know what green shoots people see. I have a hard time seeing them. It's very possible that we could inflate another bubble and keep the economy levitating for a while. But we're doing it at the price of this enormous amount of debt that we're creating, an enormous amount of debt. Now, whether that would create a severe inflation problem in the future, well, I'm not smart enough to know. But if we have a massive debt problem in the country, it makes no sense to try to solve it by creating more debt, an unimaginable amount of debt. They're doing the same thing in the UK, to an even greater percent of GDP, I believe, than we're doing it here. So maybe they'll end up with a severe problem and we'll end up with the same problem. But this is what we're doing. We're also stripping away our civil liberties. Oh, that's been going on for a long time, too. And it certainly went on under Ronald Reagan, under Bill Clinton. But it went into overdrive under George Bush in the post-9/11 climate. And I wrote a long article at the end of 2007. I called it Police State America. And I just let the evidence speak for itself. I went through a whole array of repressive police state laws, presidential executive orders, memoranda, so much, and there's been more since, that have literally been stripping away our rights. So we're being defeated economically. Our civil rights are being defeated. Our human rights are being left in tatters. And we seem to be on a fast track to becoming a militarized banana republic police state. Banana republic emphasizing, the harshness of them and the impoverishment of them. And I like to say that it looks like America is very slowly being turned into Guatemala. Well, you could say the financing of all this is because bankers have the power to create money. My goodness, well, I guess the government could have the power and be just as repressive. But it would make a lot more sense to make the country prosperous and think how popular governments could be if they did that instead of doing what we do now, spending over $1 trillion a year on militarism abroad and at home, including all the categories that are never talked about. And some of them that we really don't know how much money is being spent, all of the intelligence agencies, 16 of them in total. My goodness. Not just CIA and FBI and NSA, which is the worst one of them all. I'm doing something I've written a little on NSA before. I'm doing another article that's going to sit there for a while because I've got other stuff that I need to get out. But talk about institutionalized spying. Well, we're all spied on. Millions of us are watched all the time, and they can basically look at anything. They can find out anything they want about us. They can end up knowing more about us than we know ourselves. Everything private about us, financial, medical, you name it, and they can get at it. And it's been a while since I wrote about this, but there's some technology that has the power from space to penetrate visually through concrete walls. So I picture, I don't have a concrete wall as the outside of the building that I live in. But if I did, I kind of picture myself behind that concrete wall and the government could watch me anywhere in my apartment. That's a pretty frightening thought. Well, they don't want to be a voyeur. They just want to keep an eye on the people they want to watch for whatever reasons. So that goes on and all the rest. Well, we lost Lincoln because he did one thing well. James Garfield was the other one. I began talking about him. He lived less than a year after he became president. He was shot. He lingered for about 2 months. And I guess medical treatment wasn't of the caliber it is today. 2 months later, he died. So I don't know who shot him. But very possibly the bankers just did not like a guy like this. messing with their honeypot. Or the other president who may, I say may because I don't know, may have been against the Federal Reserve control over money with Jack Kennedy. He issued an executive order to begin printing a number of billions of dollars of, I think he called them United States notes, but basically U.S. Treasury notes, as opposed to Federal Reserve notes. Take a dollar bill out of your pocket, and it says Federal Reserve note on it. They have the signature of the Secretary of the Treasury, government official. It's a mask. It doesn't matter who signs it. Joe the Butcher could sign it. The bankers are the ones who created it. Oh, the Bureau of Engravings prints the money. That's part of the subterfuge to make it look like a government agency prints the money, which it does. It's not the printing of the money that matters. And that money in circulation is only about 3% of the so-called money supply. And it's really debt. It's not money. And it's created by accounting entries. There was a quote in Ellen's book, something to the effect like pulling money out of an empty hat. accounting entries. Oh, there's a quote. Oh, I pull the article up. She quotes another wonderful man, a man by the name of Professor Henry Liu, and he calls the money system, quote, a cruel hoax. Some of these are my words, most of them his. And that except for government-issued coins, which literally is even less than pocket change compared to the whole amount, there is virtually no real money in the system, only debts to bankers for money they created with accounting entries, all done by sleight of hand and only possible because the government empowered the bankers to do it. So you know what the solution is. We have to return the power of money to the government and let them serve us, not the powerful bankers. And if they did it, this is what Ellen writes about, we could eliminate the federal debt. This country was debt-free at only one time. Well, I guess at the beginning we may have been debt-free, but Andrew Jackson got us out of debt. He paid off the debt and made this country debt-free. Just imagine we were debt-free today. Well, it's never been that way since, and now, of course, we're in debt to an astronomical amount. I'll have to ask Ellen whether the solution she proposes, whether it would be as easy to eliminate this debt now as in the first edition of her book, which is the edition that I have. But she talks about how the federal debt could be eliminated, and I put a comment in the article that I wrote. At the very least, it could be reduced to a much more manageable amount before it mushroomed to stratospheric levels. We could eliminate the federal income tax. And we sure could do it easily if we just cut out our militarism. That's the second villain. We have no enemy in the world, and yet we spend more in the military than all other countries combined. Talk about a crime. That really is a crime. Of course, we're all paying for it. Social programs could be expanded. We could have, I'm on Medicare. We could have Medicare for everybody. Medicare isn't perfect, but it sure works well for me. I only needed it big time once. Oh, it came through flawlessly. It took care of everything. I chose my own provider. I chose my own hospital, my own doctor, my own everything. And nobody batted an eyelash. And it worked. And they paid all the bills. No questions asked. Now, how about that for a system? We could have it again. We could have a secure Social Security, which was the single most important law ever passed in 1935 under FDR that reduced poverty for seniors and others eligible for Social Security, disabled and so on. Roosevelt did a lot of wonderful things in the 1930s, but he didn't do the most important thing he should have done. He let bankers control the money. So the money he spent on productive things like building infrastructure, put a lot of people back to work, greatly reduced the unemployment rate. Terrific programs that did a lot to revive the country. He didn't do enough. Took the war to get us out of the Great Depression. But he did a lot. Stuff we're not doing now. We're doing trivia now compared to what he did. But if he had taken back the power to create money, that would have been his greatest achievement, far exceeding everything else. And we could have done what Nazi Germany did under Hitler. In a few years, the country is prosperous again. So instead of a Great Depression back in the Great Depression, we would have had a recession for a few years, and we would have come roaring out of it and been healthy again. We have to take another break. No Mike Farrell. Well, Mike, if you listen to the archive of this program, I say to you very politely, I am not a happy camper. You're the first one who ever stood me up.
This is RVN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Today was a unique program for me, the first time I went solo for a whole hour. Well, I know I can do it. I would much rather have you have a guest on to hear what they have to say. My purpose is to be a facilitator and to bring on good people. Regular listeners know the kind of people who come on this program all the time. These are the people I want you to hear so you can hear the important things, the great wisdom and the great honesty and truth that they have to convey to you. Oh, I try to do it, too. And I'm delighted to bring them on, and I'll sure have a terrific guest on tomorrow, Michael Hudson. Again, regular listeners know who he is. He is one terrific economist. Just incredible insight to what's going on, and we'll talk about the economy again. His writing is so important. I've written about his writing. He wrote a very, very long article that I wrote about, and we talked about it the last time he came on. That was on Iceland. We're going to mention Iceland at least a little briefly tomorrow because they had an election at the end of April. And people were all excited that the left defeated the right. Well, baloney. Well, Michael explained that the issue isn't left and right. The reason I wanted to talk about Iceland is Iceland is a microcosm of what's going on here in the U.S. in so many other countries and what's happening to Iceland. You could state Iceland, the population, in one corner of Chicago, a few hundred thousand people. My goodness. It would be a big suburb of Chicago and a country where 90% of the people own homes. And because of what was done to them, many of them are going to lose their homes just the way they're losing them here. They're being forced to pay outrageous debt service so that the bankers can extract their pound of flesh. It goes on and on. So Iceland is a microcosm of what's going on elsewhere. That's the reason I wanted to talk about it. So we'll talk about it a bit tomorrow and then get into the general subject of the terrible economic situation that we're in. And I suspect that we're going to have a mess on our hands for a long time to come. And if they manage to inflate another balloon for a while, then we'll end up with an even greater problem than we have now. The bankers will do just fine for themselves. Don't they always? It's only the little people, meaning, what do we have, 300-odd million people in the country. So you've got powerful bankers that you could count on certainly no more than your fingers and toes. I'm talking about the biggest and the most powerful. And, a bunch of others that may do okay. And then you've got the great majority of us, 95% of us, and we're getting whacked, including even well-off people losing their homes because they took on more than even they could handle. And of course, all the people are losing their jobs. We'll get another reading tomorrow when they come up with a number that will be pure fiction. The number, I assure you, will be a lot higher than the number they report. And we've talked about that on this program a number of times. We have a sick economy. We have a sick global economy. I truly believe, and we've talked about it in this program, that it is unprecedented in the history of global economic dilemmas. Call it whatever you want, depression, whatever. I like the term global. I like the term economic holocaust because it literally decimates so many people. Oh, they're playing my song, so that means we've come to the end of the program. Michael Hudson tomorrow, Friday. Ellen Brown on Monday. We'll pick up on her book on Monday. And I do apologize for no guest today. I carried on best I could. I hope I kept it interesting for you. And if it happens again, I'll do what I have to do. I just want to get you good information. That's my mission. Back again tomorrow. Please join us then. With recent